Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 80, Australian Aboriginal Spirituality. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I was once told that I was never going to be anything, and that, you know, that I was always going to be, you know, sort of in jail, or I was going to be dead, I was going to be a drug addict, and now I look at my life and I'm sort of like a bright star that, you know, that I have, you know, sort of made it through the tough times. And so, you know, I sort of look at my life and go, you know, hang on a minute, like, I've actually got a really easy life in comparison to what, say, my grandfather or my father was forced to grow up in, or any Indigenous people in Australia were forced to grow up in, sort of, you know, 30 or 40 or 50, 60 years ago. You know, it's, life was very tough, and today it's, you know, certainly we have access to everything that any Anglo person has access to, and, you know, that if you want something bad enough, well, then go and get it, because no one's going to give it to you.
That was the voice of my guest, Jeremy Donovan, who identifies as an Australian Aborigine. Jeremy is a descendant of both the Gumbayungur and Kuku-Yalanji tribes and has been playing didgeridoo in both traditional and contemporary performances for over 6 years, widely acclaimed as one of the leading Indigenous didgeridoo players of Australia. Jeremy's exceptional skill with the didgeridoo and extensive knowledge of his cultural heritage has earned him the recognition of his peers as a master storyteller and performer. Over the past 10 years, he's been greatly influenced by a number of tribal elders from his communities and others across Australia. These influences have given him greater ambitions to show the true richness of his amazing heritage. Today, he is an outstanding role model for both the Indigenous and non-Indigenous youth of Australia. As a result, Jeremy's masterful didgeridoo playing and passion has seen him become one of Australia's premier didgeridoo performers. Spending time with at-risk adolescents is one of Jeremy's greatest passions. Working with urban Indigenous youth, Jeremy encourages these young people to follow in his footsteps. His message is very blunt yet very powerful. Learn your culture, be proud of where you come from, and never forget the struggle the generations before us have faced. Don't blame others for your trouble or problems. You control your own destiny. Jeremy says, I make it my job to educate people from many nations around the world about the beauty of my traditional culture. Now, here's the interview. Jeremy Donovan, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm so happy to be able to talk to you way over there down under. I'm happy to say.
We're certainly a long way away.
Yeah, we are. Opposite sides of the world. But I'm happy to report that I've got a number of listeners there in Australia, and I'm sure they're going to love listening to this interview, hearing one of their own get interviewed. And you and I met at the Joshua Tree, what's it called, the Jammin' Tree?
Yeah, the Jammin' Tree Festival.
Yeah, the Jammin' Tree Festival, which is a didgeridoo festival. And I heard you tell your story there, and I was so moved by it that I wanted to invite you to be on Shrink Wrap Radio. So I don't have a lot of questions worked out in advance, and I think I'll just turn you loose to tell your story, and every now and then I may interrupt with a question or an idea. So go ahead.
No, my pleasure. I guess my story is has been – on my journey of life, you know, at 26 now, I've certainly experienced some of the biggest ups and biggest downs that, you know, most people, you know, most families will only experience once in their life, and I've sort of done it in 26 years. So my life has been a bit of a roller coaster ride, but, you know, one that has been, you know, of great learning to me as a person. I guess, you know, to start from the start, I was born initially in Melbourne, in Victoria, and raised, you know, by my mum and my stepfather until I was in Sydney. And until I was 12 years old, I didn't actually realize that my father at home wasn't actually my biological father. And when I discovered that he wasn't my biological father, my life sort of turned into a bit of a wreckage, you know, sort of, you know, completely covered in turmoil. And I guess I started facing that adolescent road of destruction, of trying to establish, well, who am I? Where do I come from? What's my role in this world? And without sort of knowing, you know, sort of my cultural identity or, you know, where I came from, it made life very difficult. I guess at 12 years old, I sort of, you know, came home from school one day and looked around at the dinner table, and I saw my beautiful mum with, you know, blonde hair and blue eyes, and my dad with blonde hair and blue eyes, and my four sisters with blonde hair and blue eyes, and I realized that I really didn't sort of fit that sort of family genre. And so from there, just sort of life and trying to answer the questions like, well, who is your real father and all those sort of things. And because I didn't know, I used to have to make up things just because it was easier than telling people that I didn't know who my real family were. And by the time I was 15, I was sentenced to 17 months in a juvenile correctional center here in Sydney, just for sort of being a bit of a repeat offender. And eventually the courts got sick of me and sentenced me to a maximum security, Mount Penang it was called, so named after a Thai prison, but this one for juveniles. And so, and this was almost, you know, sort of people looked at it as the worst thing that could have ever happened to me in my life, but I sort of look at it now as probably one of the best things that ever happened to me in life, because when I arrived in there, I was presented with, you know, sort of a world where I had to find my cultural identity, and very quickly, in order to fit in with everyone that was in that facility. And through that, I discovered that my father and my grandfather, well, my grandfather was a full-blooded Aboriginal man from far northern Queensland, sort of about 5 hours drive northwest of Cairns in northern Queensland. And, you know, and from that age at 15 and 9 months, I started a long road of discovery into learning about, you know, my father's family and my cultural background.
Well, let me jump in here then and just kind of recap and ask you a question. So it seems like in your early adolescent years, out of the confusion of, you know, wondering about your origins and who you were before you knew, you started to act out and you got yourself into trouble with the law, I guess. And
yeah,
and you were a repeat offender, you say. So you got yourself into a lot of trouble.
And yeah, well, you know, like it was one of those sort of things that it was, you know, the world that I was pushing myself into was a bit of a tough world. And you know, to live in a tough world, you sort of often have to, you know, be a bit tough sometimes. And that's what got me into trouble.
Yes, right. Now, you know, having met you, I have to say you're very light-skinned, and I don't think that looking at you, a person would jump to the conclusion that you have an Aboriginal background. So I'm wondering,
yeah,
how did that sit with you at first when you heard that you were of mixed blood? That could be, it could be upsetting information.
Yeah, well, you know, like the thing was that I was sort of, there were no Aboriginal people around in the area that I lived in ever. But there was certainly a large contingent of Polynesian, you know, sort of families, Tongan and Samoan and Maori. And a lot of people always assumed that I was just sort of, I might have had like a Maori father. And that was sort of the answer that I often gave people.
Ah.
You know, like because one of my best, I was always hanging around with the Polynesian kids. And so people often just assume, well, I must have, you know, sort of, you know, a Maori background behind me. So people had already assumed that I was, you know, from some sort of cultural identity. But yeah, it's certainly, so for me, you know, I protected myself with that lie that, yeah, no, my father was Maori, or, you know, and my mum's white.
Right.
And that was sort of the identity that I gave myself, you know, at sort of 13 years old. I used to wear one of the you know, the traditional Maori bone carvings around my neck, and it was easier to answer than to actually tell someone that I didn't know who my biological father was.
Yes. Did you ever see the film Once Were Warriors?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that powerful film about, and we can come back to this a bit, but it really showed sort of, maybe it was a similarly rough environment that you were growing up in, because that film depicts kind of rough Maori gangs in Auckland.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly, you know, there were tough times, but I mean, I think that movie certainly portrays the worst of the worst, and, you know, like I don't want to make it sound like my life was that disastrous, but, mm-hmm. you know, like, I protected myself with a strong bunch of friends, and, you know, at times, you know, the aggression and the violence that you see in that movie was, you know, a similar life that I was living.
Yes, yes. Now, because of my own background in psychology and the focus of this show, I'm wondering if while you were in the lockup there, if there were social workers or psychologists or counselors who tried to work with you.
Yeah, well, you know, definitely we have social workers and those sort of things. And in fact, it was one of the social workers that really helped me establish, I guess, my cultural identity. Because, see, I guess to a lot of the world, when I travel overseas, like, my appearance, I don't look like an Aboriginal person, because I don't look like what, you know, the magazine covers or the books or the documentaries often portray Aboriginal people to sort of look like. But here in Australia, because, you know, we have a population of 400,000 Aboriginal people here in Australia, and of that 400,000, less than 10% are of full-blooded descent, that, you know, being of mixed race is certainly a more common face than it is a, you know, to see the full-blooded face. And so, you know, to a lot of people today, you know, when I traveled, you know, they don't recognize me as Aboriginal people, but if an Aboriginal person comes, you know, into contact with me, we identify and recognize each other almost immediately.
Okay.
And this is what happened with me with the social worker. One of the Aboriginal social workers came up to me and asked me if my father was Aboriginal. And I said, I don't know. And she pretty much said that she was willing to bet her job that if she found my father, that he would be Aboriginal.
Interesting.
And so, she picked it. Yeah.
Yeah. So then what happened then to move that along to where you discovered that you actually were?
So basically, I mean, she put the question up, well, was your father Aboriginal? And I said, well, you know, to tell you the honest truth, I don't know anything about my father. And it wasn't that my mum had hidden it from me, that mum knew Dad was Aboriginal, but she just didn't want to say, oh, he was Aboriginal, but we don't know anything else. And so I basically, when mum came to visit me about 2 weeks after this first discussion with the social worker, I asked mum, I need to know, like, who Dad was and was he Aboriginal. Mum at that stage said, yes, he was Aboriginal, but we didn't want to tell you until we actually knew where he was and where his family were, in case you wanted to, you know, to search it out and find them. And so, you know, with that, the Aboriginal liaison officer, Pauline, she helped my mother and stepfather trace back where my father was, and really got the ball moving to, you know, for me to meet my father's family and sort of be reunited with them.
And how was that for you?
You know, for me, it was almost like a weight had been taken off my shoulder, that, in a sense, that finally I had a truthful answer, that I knew who my father's family were, that, you know, that, and that I knew that all of a sudden that, hey, you know, that my father was Aboriginal, and he wasn't Maori, he wasn't any other cultural background. I knew straight away that, you know, if someone asked me what nationality I was or what's your cultural background, I could tell someone, you know, both sides of my family. I didn't have to make something up. And so for me, at 16 at this stage, it made my life sort of a whole stack easier in sort of working out, you know, sort of, you know, where I come from.
Okay, so take us from there. You're 16, you found this out, and are you still in the lockup, or do they let you?
Yeah, still in the lockup. So this was about 3 months into being into sentenced, or 2.5 months being into sentenced. And from there, Pauline and my mother traced back where my father was, and And my father, we found my father, and he was in a Brisbane prison facility. And so Pauline contacted my father and spoke about me to him very briefly. And Dad said, well, you know, that he wasn't of much assistance to me at this stage of my life, that I was obviously already following, you know, in the footsteps that, you know, that he had already placed in the ground. But his father was living up on our remote Aboriginal community in northern Queensland. And so with that sort of in arms, Pauline and my mother travelled back to northern Queensland to meet with my grandfather. When my mum met my grandfather, at that stage he didn't know I existed. And so I guess like any grandfather, he was fairly alarmed that he had a grandson that he didn't know existed, and two, was in quite a large amount of trouble down in Sydney. And so Pop agreed to sort of come back to Sydney with my mum to meet me. And so and that's where that introduction was initiated behind bars at Carry On there, that I met my grandfather. After 5 weeks of my grandfather being in Sydney, sort of spending time with me to sort of, you know, sort of getting to know each other and also doing blood comparisons to make sure that we have got the right grandfather, then the juvenile remand system agreed to release me on a conditional bail that I would spend my sentence in isolation living with my grandfather up on our remote community. And so with that, I was released and sent back to northern Queensland, where I spent 17 months living with my father's family up on our community.
Oh, what a wonderfully enlightened sentence that judge was, you know, that they were willing to do that.
Yeah, I mean, they were willing to do that. Believe me, for the first 3 months of being back up in northern Queensland, I wished I could go back to Sydney, because, you know, life at that stage in a juvenile remand centre was so much more luxurious than living where I was living. Sort of, you know, the juvenile remands, while they might be tough on the outside, they're certainly, you've got all the luxuries in the life over here. You've still got, you know, pizzas and movies and pool tables and games and education and all those sort of things. Whereas, you know, I was moving up to an environment to live with my grandfather and his sister, where we lived in a traditional gunya, which had no electricity, no running water. A lot of our food was still, you know, sort of fish from the rivers, you know, with the turtle and the fish. So, you know, but for the first 3 months, all I wanted to do was go home, back to jail.
Yeah. But then somehow that began to turn for you.
I guess what happened was that my grandfather made me realize that, you know, where I come from and just how deeply rooted, you know, these cultural traditions are, you know, in my family. And, you know, one of the things, you know, like I stood out like a sore thumb up in our community. I looked like an albino in comparison to the rest of my family. But, you know, my grandfather said something pretty, you know, I asked him, was I going to fit in because of, you know, obviously having light skin and being, you know, having a white mother, that, you know, was I going to be accepted? And my grandfather sort of quickly put that, you know, put water on the fire to that was, and he said, you know, you can take the colour out of someone, but you can't take the culture out of someone. And this is your land, and as much your land as it is my land. And so, you know, and with that, sort of, I was never ever treated any differently by any of my family members. In fact, a lot of them sort of felt sorry for me in the sense that I had been, you know, raised in the city with no cultural identity.
And so that began to change. You began to work on acquiring that culture, and your grandfather began to work on transmitting it to you. Isn't that right?
Yeah, well, you know, like basically what happened was that I started to appreciate what my grandfather was offering me, you know, and that I started to really enjoy all the culture, and slowly things became, you know, relatively sort of natural for me to learn the songs, the dance, the, you know, the stories, the artwork. It all sort of started to become, you know, a fairly natural process for me, and I wasn't sort of battling, and I wasn't feeling that I was an outsider. All of a sudden, sort of after about 4 or 5 months being there, I felt like it was the life that I'd always had. And, you know, it was funny that, you know, about 3 days after arriving up there with my grandfather, I had to go to Cooktown to fill out some papers at the Cooktown police station with my grandfather. And I spoke to my mum at that stage as well, and I said to my mum, you know, for the first time in my life, like, I knew where home was. There was just something about that land when I got out of the car for the first time up there that I knew that was home. Mm-hmm. And there was no question about that to me. And that's why still today, like, while I'm based in Sydney, I've been raised in Sydney, you know, I don't call Sydney home. I call Northern Queensland home because it's the place that really makes me feel like that's home.
And a whole sense of spirituality has opened up for you as well as you become reunited with your roots.
Yeah, you know, definitely, like, I guess I became sort of fairly appreciative of, you know, sort of all the cultural stories. And with that, you know, a deep sense of spirituality has, you know, has been awoken. And also, it, you know, it continues to grow with me that, you know, I start, you know, sort of appreciating that, you know, that the Great Spirit works in a weird and wonderful way and often presents us with difficulties that we have to overcome. And so it's definitely awoken a big, you know, sort of a big spiritual path for me in my life.
That really came through when I saw you perform here in California. And as you spoke about your sense of, you've traveled around the world quite a bit now. And
yeah.
And you really carry with you a message of universal love and acceptance, and also connection to nature. Can you say?
Yeah, well, you know, like, nature and the wildlife is something that, you know, has played a big part of my life. You know, even as a city kid, and even in the most trouble in the world, that I always had time as a kid for the bush. It was, you know, I always had a natural affinity for the bush. And so, you know, it's still today, it just continues to get stronger, in fact, you know. And the other thing is, as I get older, I have a far greater need to go back to Northern Queensland more frequently. Like, I've been home twice already this year, so, and I imagine there will be probably another 5 or 6 times again, you know, throughout the year, you know, pending time availability, so... You know, like, as I get older, I do yearn, you know, to go back and sit up on the country with my uncles and aunties up there.
Mm. And now you're a father yourself, right?
Yeah, I've got 2 little boys, one that's 18 months old and the other one that is 4 and a half. So, you know, for me, it's really nice seeing these kids grow up, you know, knowing, one, who they are, knowing both their mum and dad, knowing they are Aboriginal Australians, that they can be very proud of their, you know, of who they are and, you know, of where they come from. So it's really nice. And, you know, I guess my wife, both her parents are Aboriginal. So my kids, you know, they're far more Indigenous, you know, than I look. But, you know, it's certainly, they know that Dad plays didgeridoo for a living and talks about Aboriginal culture. And, you know, even when my son was at school the other day, they asked him what he wants to do when he grows up, and he said he wants to play didgeridoo. So,
now, how did you meet your wife?
I met my wife. I was friends with her younger sister through high school down here in Sydney, and then, you know, we were introduced 7 years ago now. So.
That's great.
And we've sort of been side by side ever since then, except for when I'm sort of traveling overseas.
Okay, and you've got several CDs out now, don't you, with your didgeridoo playing?
Yeah, so I mean, initially, like, my first ever time I recorded it was on a feature artist on an album called Sounds of the Outback Volume 2, which is sort of the music that I play doing the show in Darling Harbour that I operate. My first solo production was Breathe and Easy, a CD called Breathe and Easy, which I sort of, you know, every now and then I listen to it and I think, wow, I've really developed a lot in the last couple of years. And then the CD after that was a CD called Heart and Soul, which was a didgeridoo and hip-hop bass. And it was a CD that I didn't really do for myself, that it was a production that I did when I went back into the juvenile remand centres about 3 years ago to work with young Aboriginal kids about sort of projecting a positive image and to have a dream. And, you know, if you really love, you know, hip-hop music and rap and all those sort of things, that's great. There's nothing wrong with that music. But let's not rap about sort of being gangbangers and you know, all that sort of crap, because, you know, we don't have that life here in Australia. And let's rap about a culture that's been, you know, sort of present on this land for 60,000 years. And so I sort of taught the kids, you know, sort of that they can, you know, sort of really appreciate their culture and project their cultural sounds into sort of modern hip-hop music. And so that was a fun project for me. You know, it's, when I listened to the CD, it was, you know, it really reflects what the kids were going through. So that was sort of a great production for, you know, sort of for the kids and what the kids got out of it and what benefit they got out of it. The CDs that I work on now, that I've been working on now, like sort of 2 years or a year ago, I recorded Yalanji, which is, you know, to date is, you know, is my favorite CD, which really, I think, sort of, you know, projects, you know, who I am and sort of, you know, the world that I walk in today. So it's a good representation of me. And then just the last 2 weeks, I've been in the recording studio recording two new albums. One is a completely solo album, which I'm recording it, and I want people to use it for sort of spiritual journey and deep meditation. And that CD is, it's titled Never Alone, Walking with Spirit. And then I've got a contemporary album that'll come out, which is going to be called Same Blood, Different Skin.
What was that title again?
It's called Same Blood, Different Skin.
Same Blood, Different Skin. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I will definitely put a link to your website on the on the show notes on the website associated with this show.
Because I've got a new website now, because I used to operate didgeridooboy.com.
Yeah.
And I know if people type that in, then it'll still get linked back to my new website, but my new website is jeremydonovan.com.au.
Okay, I'm just making a note of that. So what can you tell us about Aboriginal spirituality? What have you learned about Aboriginal spirituality?
I guess, you know, one of the finest things that my grandfather ever, you know, sort of taught me was that, you know, I asked him not long after being up there, I said to him, Dad, why do we do all this? Why do we sing? Why do we dance? Why do we paint? Why do we, you know, play didgeridoo? And my pop just simply said, it's no different to a family that sits down, you know, every night at dinner and puts their head in their hands and says a prayer. I mean, they're saying or acknowledging, you know, something that was greater than them for the life that's provided. And that's exactly the same thing that, you know, is our culture is based on, that we must acknowledge, you know, sort of the ancestral spirits who created the life and the laws of the country for us. And we also must acknowledge the animals who are our next of kin in the animal world. And they rose from the earth at the same time as us. And also, you know, they sacrifice their life so we can live, you know, with warmth and with food. So, you know, it's, you know, in terms of our, you know, spiritual culture, we definitely, you know, live a strong life, you know, honoring our ancestral spirits, honoring our family that have passed, our deceased, you know, and acknowledging their spirit is always walking with us.
Okay. And,
like, you know, like there's times when I'm up on stage and if I really am in that right space and I really start, if I start to sing like a traditional song, like I can smell my grandfather's presence. Like I can smell his air. Like it, you know, and it makes me cry almost every time up on stage and I can smell that smell.
He's passed on?
Yeah. He passed on sort of, I guess, 4 years ago now.
Uh-huh.
It'll be 5 years in July. Uh-huh. It was just after the birth of my first son.
Wow. But you still feel his presence very close by, it sounds like.
Oh, immensely. Like, it's, you know, there's probably never a day. I guess, you know, I live my life talking about my culture, and I live my life talking about, you know, the people who have influenced my life. And so, you know, it's always spoken about. So it's so present in my everyday life that, you know, that I always am feeling that his presence and where he is, and, you know, and that he's always with me.
Yes, that's wonderful. I'm wondering about the concept of dream time, which I've heard associated with Aboriginal culture and spirituality. Is that something that you're familiar with, that you can explain at all?
You know, like, Dreamtime's a funny word. I often get asked this in my show in Sydney, that, you know, what is Dreamtime? Well, I'll tell you what Dreamtime is. It's an expression that the Europeans first gave our traditional beliefs, because when the first missionaries were colonizing our Aboriginal communities and started sort of interacting with our people and speaking English to our people, they were trying to understand and grasp what it was that we believed in. And we were telling them about these mythical serpents and mythical beings that created our country and created our laws. And as you can imagine, the Anglo, you know, sort of Catholic missionaries, you know, were pretty horrified at what we were saying. And so they told us that what we believed in was only in your dreams. It was crazy dreams. And so they referred to our, you know, spiritual belief says dream time. And so, you know, and then they said, here's the Bible and this is what you now have to believe in. And that's where that actually came from. But really the word dream time should be translated into creation time, because the dream time is what we believe as our creation story.
Uh-huh.
So it's even known as, like, traditionally as Dukapa or Chiringa, or Dangala in my father's language is what means, like, our family's creation is our Dangala.
Okay. And is there an Aboriginal understanding of actual dreams? That's a topic that I'm interested in and have spoken about on this show. What's the understanding of dreams?
Well, you know, like, dreams are often perceived as like insights or sacred messages, depending on what the dream might have been, you know, focused on. So I guess, you know, like, I know from sort of, you know, spending time and speaking to sort of some of the Native American Indians, like, I think the dreams play a bigger role in their culture and their history than they do in our traditional, you know, sort of culture
mm-hmm.
and life.
Go ahead.
We sort of, instead of dreams, you know, for our people sort of rely on sort of contact with spirit, and with spirits, to provide us with information. And so we need to do that through chanting and through singing and those sort of things. But it's kind of funny, like, this is something that is fairly recent. About 2 weeks ago, I was asleep in bed next to my wife, and my wife woke me up from my sleep because I was actually singing and chanting, like, in my sleep. I was singing one of our traditional songs, and my wife got sort of a bit thrown off by it and woke me up saying, what are you doing? And the next morning, about sort of no more than about 4 hours later, my uncle, who is my father's brother, called me up and said that we were in ceremony last night and we were singing. So, those sort of things that I just got goosebumps thinking about that, because it was just such a, you know, sort of intense sort of feeling.
Yes, yes.
And when I woke up, I actually felt really exhausted, like the same sort of feeling that I'd get if I have sat through a ceremony with my family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it was certainly that was the first time I've ever had, you know, sort of anything like that happen. But yeah, it was definitely a strange thing for my wife, you know, to sort of be laying in bed next to her husband who's in a deep sleep but singing in his sleep. So.
Right.
But I was possessed.
What's going to happen when you start dancing in your sleep?
Yeah.
So I wonder, what was it like for you? You had the opportunity to meet Native Americans in this country, and maybe Aboriginal people from other lands. What's that like for you?
Yeah, I think that's the reason why I love coming to America and Canada so much, is that there is that presence of Aboriginal Americans, like the Native Americans, and for me, there's nothing more sort of empowering spiritually than to sit down with another native person from their land and sort of compare stories and just be sort of amazed and mesmerized at how similar our stories and our culture was, but just so different, you know, and so far away. So, you know, I love it. You know, sort of up at the Jamming Tree Festival, I sort of had to become a mediator and almost a counselor. Because, you know, there were some young Native American kids going through you know, some tough times with drug and alcohol up there, and I sort of sat down with these kids and sort of shared my life with them, and it was almost the exact life they were living at, you know, at that stage. And, you know, for me, it was really nice that I could reach out and touch one of these, you know, kids with a story from my country and from my, you know, traditional background, and relate to these, you know, young kids that were going through the same hard times that I went through. And I think that's why I'll never stop coming back to the States. And a lot of people sort of say, why do you go to the States and why do you do this so much? And I think it is because of that Native American contact that I always seem to bump into. That, you know, I went to a George Thorogood concert in the House of Blues, and I walked in and the first person I met was, you know, a Native American person. He was there with like about 10 members of his family, and we just sort of clicked, and we're supposed to be watching a concert, but we just talked about culture the whole night. And it's that sort of bond that you have with other Indigenous people that I just don't see anywhere else.
Yeah. Have you had a chance to go to a Indian reservation in this country?
Yeah, I've been to a couple of, I went to a Navajo reservation. And when I was up at the Jamming Tree Festival, I went out to the Miwok and the Mono reservations, which are the local people that live in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like for me, it rung bells that, you know, there's, you know, almost exactly the same problems that, you know, our Indigenous people face on our Aboriginal reservations out here in Australia. There's a lot of sort of, you know, impoverished conditions in some places, and a lot of drug and alcohol abuse, and the physical abuse and the sexual abuse, and, you know, all that sort of stuff that we face, you know, that we battle against, you know, here in Australia in our communities, the Native American people are, you know, sort of battling through it. I mean, the only thing that separates us, you know, we don't have casinos here in Australia.
Maybe you'll take a tip from them, huh?
Yeah.
So, how,
you know, like we have taken a tip in the sense that, sure, you know, like the casinos can work really well sometimes, but they can also be, you know, incredibly damaging. If one family gets really rich and the rest of the people remain impoverished, then that becomes an even bigger problem than they had than before.
Yes. So how do you cope psychologically with the very depressing issues that exist there in terms of the, you know, that you were just talking about, when Western civilization has impacted Aboriginal peoples, it always seems to have resulted in, you know, damage to their story, to their pride, to their integration, and with consequent problems,
yeah,
you know, social problems such as you've outlined. How do you cope with that?
I guess, you know, like me personally, like I sort of take it in my stride that I was once told that I was never going to be anything, and that, you know, that I was always going to be, you know, sort of in jail, or I was going to be dead, I was going to be a drug addict. And now I look at my life and I'm sort of like a bright star that, you know, that I have, you know, sort of made it through the tough times. And so, you know, I sort of look at my life and go, you know, hang on a minute, like I've actually got a really easy life in comparison to what, say, my grandfather or my father was forced to grow up in, or any Indigenous people in Australia were forced to grow up in sort of, you know, 30 or 40 or 50, 60 years ago. You know, life was very tough. And today it's, you know, certainly we have access to everything that any Anglo person has access to. And, you know, that if you want something bad enough, well, then go and get it, because no one's going to give it to you. And so I certainly sort of, you know, I look at all the hard things and all the problems that are in Aboriginal culture, and instead of sort of, you know, blaming people, you know, around, you know, blaming society, you know, for those problems, I try and get sort of other Indigenous people to say, listen, let's not deny that the problems are here as a result of colonization, but, you know, colonization has happened everywhere in the world, and, you know, its effects have been quite, you know, horrific everywhere in the world. But, you know, we can't change that. We can't go back in time. We can't educate the people, you know, who colonized the land any better. And, you know, so let's, instead of blame the world for our problems, let's address our problems, because today we have an educated Indigenous population that has the power to speak for themselves. And let's address the problems and let's fix the problems. But I guess the one battle that Aboriginal people here in Australia is that, you know, that a lot of people are really quick to, you know, to cast judgments upon our culture, you know, and so, you know, they really love to push all the headlines about the sexual abuse onto the front pages of the paper, and they really love to put it onto the current affairs programs, but they don't actually talk about, you know, why those problems are there. Well, you know, that's what I sort of try and do when I address sort of people of non-Indigenous, you know, backgrounds that, you know, come on, instead of just referring to Aboriginal people as drunks, let's talk about who put the alcohol there, because we certainly didn't have alcohol before European settlement. And let's talk about the sexual abuse. I mean, we didn't really have sort of, you know, records or documentation of rape and sexual abuse until after the missionaries came in and started colonizing our communities. And then, you know, sort of all the raping, you know, started to be occurred, you know, to our women. And so all these sort of problems that we're facing on our communities today, they're problems that were brought onto our communities by Western civilization. So, you know, and we're a minority population, and as a result, you know, the headlines are always, or unfortunately, you know, primarily negative headlines. So for me personally, I try and just sort of say, you know, hang on, I'm not going to blame anyone for anything in my life. Like, I'm not going to blame people for, you know, the tough times that I went through. I'm going to say that I chose that road, but I also chose the road to walk away from it. So I try and just stay as positive as I possibly can, and sort of also try and stay, you know, politically correct and not make anyone feel uncomfortable as well, because I know that that's how you really lose attention. If you start going in and saying, you know, these white people have done this and the white people have done that, then you certainly lose, you know, the attention. And instead of sort of approaching it with an educated and politically, you know, sort of correct sort of view, you know, you can keep the attention for longer and affect more people.
Well, I totally agree. I think you're very wise in the choice that you're making. And certainly you're very well positioned to kind of bridge the two cultures. And you are a bright star, and I'm sure you're a bright star to young people who are searching for their path. And boy, yeah. You're still young. You've got a ways to go. There's more to learn, more wisdom to develop, huh?
Yeah, it was funny. I was talking to someone yesterday, and someone said, "Why don't you write a book?" And I was like, "Because I don't want to have to write a sequel." You know, so if my first 26 years have been this interesting, I can't imagine what the next 26 are going to be like. So I said, I'll wait till I'm about 52, and then I'll just write one big book.
Okay. Actually, as you were telling your story, I was imagining it cinematically. I mean, it would make a wonderful movie.
Yeah. You know, that's something that I think I'd really love to do, is to really sort of, you know, whether it's a short film or a long film, really project this, you know, sort of story to the world and sort of showcase what sort of mixed-blooded Indigenous people can go through, you know, in their life, trying to find their balance and trying to find their cultural sort of identity.
Yeah, I think there's a great film there. So hold that thought, and maybe you'll draw the resources to you for that to come to pass. Well, we probably should begin to wrap it up here. Is there any sort of last message that you'd like to give, or any last thoughts?
No, you know, like if there's one last thought that I can, you know, that I could ever give someone is just, you know, that great simple message is don't believe the headlines. Sort of look a lot deeper than, you know, and there's so much beauty and so much rich sort of culture, you know, behind sort of some of the problems that we do face in Indigenous cultures around the world. And so instead of sort of sticking that stereotype of, you know, being drunks or, you know, or problems with gambling or problems with, you know, whatever problems we face in our life, instead of focusing on them, focus on, well, you know, all the really beautiful things that you've heard about the culture. And I think if we do that with every culture or every faith in the world, we would, you know, have far less sort of, you know, sort of hatred in the world, because we'd be focusing on the positives opposed to the negatives.
That's a great wrap-up. Jeremy Donovan, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hey, my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Jeremy Donovan. It might seem like a strange choice for the show for me to have invited him on, but to me, it seems to me that in Aboriginal culture, I'm not sure that there's a dividing line between spirituality and psychology. And it seems to me that this young man has developed a tremendous amount of psychological and spiritual wisdom well beyond his 26 years. And I just wanted to be able to share that with you. There are ways in which his story resonates with my own. I could really identify with his quest to find his real father, because I also didn't know who my real father was when I was quite young. And I also had suffered from confusion around my own ethnic identity, particularly in those early years, even somewhat subsequently. And I can't remember how much of my own story in that regard that I may have already told here. After 80 shows, I'm beginning to lose track, and I know I'm bound to repeat myself, so I hope you'll forgive me if I do. But I had a stepfather from infancy who was black, and so I think that I grew up in the early years assuming that he was my real father and that I was half black. I remember some of my black playmates when I was really little saying, "Hey man, what are you?" And I would say, "I'm half white milk, half chocolate milk." So I remember that so clearly. And then at some point, you know, how sort of family secrets and so on, they sort of leak out to children in ways that children begin to make guesses and form a hypothesis, and they sort of know things in a vague way, but not very explicitly. And at some point, I began to understand that this wasn't my biological father. And then later, that knowledge was made more explicit for me, and then I found out that my biological father was in fact Jewish, and that was harder for me to digest, actually, than it would have been to actually have been half black, because I was emotionally prepared to be black, but I was not emotionally prepared to be Jewish. I had been exposed to a fair amount of anti-Semitism already and knew that that was a dangerous thing to be. So it really took years before I felt I could be open with people about my heritage. And now I can, you know, put it out to the world, as you hear here. Unlike Jeremy, I didn't get into trouble with the law, although I easily could have. I had some close calls and some opportunities to kind of go down that path and maybe explore it a little bit. But there were positive influences in my life that ultimately saved me from going to jail and having other terrible things happen along those lines. So I could really relate to Jeremy in that way and that part of his story. And in truth, another reason why I had Jeremy on the show relates to my own interest in learning to play the didgeridoo, which I've been working on now for 2 or 3 years, ever since I did a workshop in Kauai with my friend Ron Alexander. And there was a young man there who was playing the didgeridoo, and he said, "Oh, it's really easy." He had learned it in half an hour. Well, I have not found it so easy as to learn in half an hour. Somehow that instrument really speaks to me. The drone, I really like the drone. It reminds me of Tibetan chanting, and it seems to me like a very meditative sound. And so I keep sort of working on it in bits and starts, fits and starts, I guess is the expression. And I've kind of got the circular breathing down now a bit, but I seem to run out of breath. I can't seem to get the balance just right. And I find that the back pressure blocks up my nose. And maybe that's just an excuse. I don't know. I can tell you Jeremy is a wonderful performer. I got to see him at this didgeridoo event that we spoke of, and also to hear his story there. And it was just moved both by him as a performer and by the power of his spiritual and psychological message. And so the music that you heard at the beginning of the show and the little interludes, those are his excerpts of his music. And at the end of the show, I'll take you out with some of his music. He's got 3 CDs, and you can purchase them off of his website, which once again is www.jeremydonovan.com.au, and I'll also put a link to that in the show notes on the website at shrinkwrapradio.com. A big thank you to our sponsors, Podshow and GoDaddy. You'll find great GoDaddy discounts for all your domain name and web hosting needs on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. For example, Shrink3 is the discount code to get a web domain for $6.99 instead of $8.99. Plus, in doing so, you'll be supporting this show. If you haven't filled it out yet, you'll find our listener survey at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm. And also, there's a link on the Shrink Wrap Radio website to it. And if you include your name and email address, you'll get a little surprise. Now, I thought you might be interested in some of the results of that survey. At present, 193 people have filled it out. 61% are male and 39% are female. In terms of age, about 12% of you seem to be in the 15 to 24 year range. About 34% of you are in the 25 to 34 year range. And about 25% are in the 35 to 44 year range. And about 29% of you are 45 and older. So we've got a nice spread all the way across the age spectrum. Looking at it another way, about half of you are under 37 years of age, and about half are over that. About 54% of you are employed, and about 18% of you are self-employed, while 17% are students. In terms of education, 28% of you have graduated from college, 41% of you have graduate degrees, so you're a smart, educated bunch, which I already knew from the emails I've received. And half of you make more than $50,000 U.S. per year. So maybe I'll give you more results from the survey in future episodes. We have one new addition to our Frapper map. I don't think I've welcomed this person before. So I want to give a big thank you and welcome to Chad in Monterey, California. And there's a place on the Shrink Wrap Radio website where the rest of you can add yourself to our Frapper map if you haven't done so already. Okay, we've got time for some mail. First, we hear from regular listener and correspondent Stefan in Austria, who writes, "Hello, Doc. Thanks for the interesting shows on Leary and the Enneagram. I am glad you like that show on Leary. I was expecting maybe to get a lot of feedback on it, and this is the first word I've had." Stefan goes on to say, "I think it would be interesting to explore the origins of the Enneagram a little more, especially the teachings of Gurdjieff. I think there are quite interesting parallels between the spiritist craze around the turn of the century and the esoteric boom around the turn of the millennium." Yeah, I'm sure you're right about that. "I'm currently playing a lot with the Universal Weight Tarot. I'm glad you got me interested in this deck. I often find it more accessible than the Crowley deck I've been using so far." Yeah, me too. That's why I like it. He goes on to say, "Some cards seem to have quite a contrasting meaning. I would like to get a Tarot expert's opinion on that sometime." I think the contrasting meaning, in a way, I mean, that's part of the value of the cards, is that they can represent polarities. But I'm sure you've got some local experts that could give you more insight into that, Stefan. Stefan goes on to say, "I'm also reading Alberto Villoldo's book, Shaman, Healer, Sage, at the moment." And let me just say here that Alberto Villoldo was a guest on an earlier Shrink Wrap Radio. And if you didn't hear that episode, you should find it, because I think that was one of the very best. And also, I have to say that I prefer Shaman, Healer, Sage is a good book, but I was very impressed by his more recent book on soul retrieval. Okay, back to Stefan's letter. He says, "I find it very interesting." Well, let me start at the beginning again. "I'm also reading Alberto Villoldo's book, Shaman, Healer, Sage, at the moment. I find it very interesting and easy to read. The concept of energetic healing is something that I find a little difficult to accept, though it also it seems very plausible, especially when you hear well-established, quote, scientists, end quote, talk about it in such a convincing way. If one believes their claims, it seems clearly superior to psychotherapy. We all know that the fundamental problems in our lives rarely disappear completely. Often they are unexpectedly reactivated when we think that we have long ago found a way to deal with them. I'm also convinced that the mainly intellectual approach of psychotherapy, at least traditional styles, simply cannot reach the entire human being with its emotional, spiritual, and as it seems, energetic aspect. It's probably not all in the mind after all. So says he. He says, keep on turning out those great shows like hotcakes. Thank you, Stefan. I'm doing my best to do that. It's always great to hear from you. Next, we hear from Leiden, who writes, and I'm not sure where Leiden is, but the name Leiden makes me wonder if he might be Irish or in Ireland. It's got that kind of a feel to me. He writes, hi, Dr. Dave. I find myself so excited and thrilled by your last program that I just have to write. I'm referring to the Wise Counsel podcast where you're speaking to Dr. Young regarding schema therapy. Wow, listening to Dr. Young expound his theory was like wonderful. I have been building a theory of that type for a while now, slowly, painstakingly, piecing it together, and bang, suddenly there it is. I can't tell you how reassuring and energizing that feels. And then he writes in parentheses, at some time in the future, can you have another session on schema therapy, this time perhaps for Shrink Wrap Radio? Go on, you know you want to, he says. And then he adds, on a general note, I've listened to all your Shrink Wrap Radio programs and have loved them all. All the effort and time put into the delivery of your programs shows and is appreciated. Don't stop, keep going. You are bringing joy to many subscribers. Looking forward to your next program, Leiden. Well, Leiden, thank you so much for that feedback and that encouragement. And it's a good reminder to let people know that they can listen to the new set of podcasts that I'm putting out there called Wise Counsel, which you will find on a website that's called mentalhelp.net. And the interview with Dr. Jeffrey Young on schema therapy, it was a wonderful interview. I learned a lot myself in that interview and was very impressed by his approach. So maybe I will bring him on to Shrink Wrap Radio, but also people could just go listen to the one on Wise Counsel. And I just did another interview. It's not quite up there yet, but I did one yesterday on an approach to therapy called ACT, which I didn't know anything about. And that one is equally convincing and equally impressive. It's a wonderful interview. It was with the doctor, Stephen C. Hayes. And that's definitely one that you're going to want to listen to. And I might have to do a separate interview with him for this show. I don't know. I did interview one person twice, you know, once for this show, once for the other show. And the second interview, it just didn't seem to have as much energy in it, maybe because he had said the stuff before and I had asked, similar questions before and kind of knew where it was all going to go. So that's causing me to wonder whether it really makes sense to interview the same person for both shows. That's still an open question in my mind. I was also happy to receive an email from KFC, who has a podcast called Podchick, and it's a very positively oriented podcast in which he tries to share her own upbeat philosophy of life with her listeners. She's got a number of podcasts, and that's the one that I know best. And she writes, hi, Dr. Dave, long time no chat. I've gone through much change over the past few months. I now live in L.A. She had previously lived in Toronto. And she says, I'm doing a few new shows. She says, why I'm writing now, I was asked by Blogger and Podcaster magazine to list my favorite feel-good podcasts. I'm listing your show, Shrink Wrap Radio, as one of my faves. I just wanted to let you know I'm still around and do love your work. Take care and best to you. Make them smile, KFC. So you can find her at www.podchick.com. And thanks so much. Good to hear from you, KFC. And by the way, I have heard of that new magazine, Blogger and Podcaster. I haven't seen it yet. I think it's going to be both an online magazine and available in print for those who want to pay the extra cost of receiving it in print. So that's something for us all to keep our eyes on. Finally, I hear from longtime listener and frequent writer Lloyd in Australia, way down under. And by the way, Lloyd, congratulations on your new baby boy. So glad to hear about that. Lloyd wrote, Hi, let me share with you one of my defining synchronicities. It's very short and to the point, as the really good ones are. A few years ago, I was fretting about my future direction. I decided, I believe for the first time ever, to ask a question of the universe to show me what my future should be. Immediately after, I walked out of my bedroom into the living room where my flatmate was watching TV. On the screen, a woman was talking, and in the background, a large sign read, "Your future is in the cards." Simple as that, a direct, immediate answer to my question. No symbolism required. God himself might as well come down and told me. I'm not yet ready to really act on that as of yet, but more and more, I feel I will become a tarot card reader. Well, interesting. That message, your future is in the cards. I jokingly inquire, Lloyd, how do you know it's about the tarot? Maybe you're supposed to become a professional gambler. And in a separate email, Lloyd wrote, in regards to the new music which I've been playing by listener Nir Ben Zion and his friend, and Lloyd says, in regards to that new music, although I appreciate it as a musical piece, I much prefer the old, more laid-back piece. Suits your tone and style perfectly. So Lloyd says the only feedback I've gotten on the musical change, and of course today's show is entirely different. It's sort of one-off. It's all didgeridoo music, but I'd love to hear from more people whether they prefer the older jazz theme or the newer theme. It's, you know, I'm open to change.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Brother Bernard Seif in Broadheadsville, Pennsylvania. I'm calling just to let everyone know that even monks listen to Shrink Wrap Radio. Thanks for the great podcasts.
Well, thank you, Brother Bernard, for that transition. And I'm hoping other people will leave me some nice transitions using my Chingo. And you'll find a link to that at shrinkwrapradio.com. Just look for the My Chingo logo, or you can record one on our voicemail on our phone at 206-888-2746. And of course, I thrive on your emails, which you can send to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And don't forget, you can also leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. This has been an exciting week for Dr. Dave. For one thing, I was quoted extensively last week in the San Francisco Chronicle in a front page article about the new Zodiac movie. And because of my co-authoring a book on the Zodiac serial killer, I was contacted by a variety of reporters, and one of the interviews, as I say, ended up in a front page story. I was also to be kind of a headliner in a Fox News TV coverage story, but I wasn't at home when they contacted me, so I missed out on that one, but that's okay. The other thing, however, that all this media attention to the movie has done is to escalate the rank of our book on Amazon.com. My son tells me that he checked at one point and saw that it was ranked at somewhere around number 5,000, which is amazing because we used to be way down on the list. The book came out 3 years ago, so, you know, wouldn't expect it to be very high. And I checked yesterday and it was ranked at 15,000th. Well, that's still not too shabby for a book that's 3 years old. But then the other thing that came to my attention yesterday is that if you go to the iTunes Music Store, and I know many of you subscribe to this podcast through iTunes, if you go to the iTunes Store and you go into the podcast area, currently Shrink Wrap Radio is featured at the top of the front page in iTunes. I mean, you don't even have to search for Shrink Wrap Radio. It's just up there next to the Ellen DeGeneres Show and some other very popular podcast entities. And it's kind of in rotation. You might have to wait a little bit. I don't know how much longer it will be there, but it's been up evidently for about a week. And I'm loving it. And I've noticed that the numbers have gotten bumped up as a result. Also, my videos on YouTube, there's still just three up there. I'm trying to get a fourth up, and each of the three now have well over 2,000 hits, 2,000 viewers. And my whole purpose for doing that was to try to build the listenership for Shrink Wrap Radio. I haven't heard from anybody here on Shrink Wrap Radio that they've come to it as a result of the YouTube videos. So if you did, drop me an email and let me know. I'd just like to know whether or not that PR effort has been a successful one or not. Thanks again to my guest, Jeremy Donovan, for the interview. For those of you who might be wondering whether we've gotten too far off the beaten track of traditional psychology, I think you'll like our next show, which is on anxiety disorders, and it's packed with neurophysiological research information. My guest on that show will be Dr. Wayne Eastlack. I've already recorded the interview, and it's a good one. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.